Welcome to Well 89. I'm Blake, here with Kurt.
Hi, Blake. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. How was your week?
Really good, actually. I had a really good week. I just got back from doing a little bit of off-roading yesterday. Went up and actually saw some snow. It's the first time I've seen snow in quite a long time. So it was only in a few little spots, and we had to go up to about 6,500 feet of elevation to see a little bit.
Well, our mounds of snow are just starting to melt.
So now we drove up a little dirt road yesterday and got up to where there was a little bit of snow so the kids could throw some snowballs at each other. Nice day though yesterday.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been getting warm here, so at least spring seems like it's coming out.
Coming out, huh? So cool. What do you got to talk about today?
Yeah, getting started on some science. So I don't know if you've heard about the internal ocean that they were talking about on Ganymede. Have you heard much about that?
Oh, the ocean on Ganymede. Yeah, like a saltwater. They're saying there's a saltwater ocean there.
Yeah, so pretty much, you know, back, you know, several years ago, there was a prediction that this type of thing was possible. But pretty much the Hubble Space Telescope used the ultraviolet to look at Ganymede's aurora. And they were measuring the difference or the exchange between Ganymede's auroras and that of Jupiter and the magnetic field interactions. And what they found is that the overall change when Ganymede's electric field is impacted by Jupiter, so it would switch based on its current orbit around Jupiter. Okay. And that difference from one side to the other was much smaller than what should be there if there is no liquid ocean underneath. So pretty much what they'd come up with was several different, you know, ways that this ocean could present itself underneath the surface of Ganymede. So it could either be 100 kilometer long or 100 kilometer deep ocean with pretty relatively low salinity. I don't know the exact value, and that would be about 150 to 250 kilometers deep within Ganymede. But it could also be the same data could also be explained by a 10 to 20 kilometer deep, really high salinity ocean that is about 200 kilometers below the surface of Ganymede. And then it could also be explained by a very thin layer, even deeper. So we don't really know exactly, but we do know that it appears there is some type of countering electromagnetic field that is going against the aurora that is being created based on its orbit around Jupiter. And from that, we can just go off in speculations about what a saline solution underneath a possibly, it's not superheated, right? But it's not iced. So life obviously comes up.
Right. So it's basically there's this good evidence that there's the high likelihood of liquid water of some type. Underneath the surface.
The only difference between this one and what actually is another topic that they had talked about the day before the Ganymede information came out was about Encladius, where they have these we can get into that later, but they have these silicon particles that they found, and that ocean they feel is in contact with very hot rock. And like I said, I'll get into that in a second. But this Ganymede ocean is actually quenched between an icy mantle that is, crystallinity because it's extremely more compressed, and the outer surface of the planet.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, it seems unlikely. I don't know. It's based on what we know about how life develops, at least on this planet. It seems sort of unlikely that water that's that deep potentially would be able to develop the life. But
well, no, I disagree. I guess with heat and some type of salt to act as a catalyst. And you have liquid water. We've seen stuff like that here on our planet. That's seems much more unlikely. And keep in mind that Ganymede is larger than Mercury. It's a pretty large world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I wonder, some of the things that we've talked about in the past or have been talked about in terms of, precipitating life have to do with, some of those building blocks sort of coming in from asteroid impacts and things like that. So, you wonder if it's if that water would have to be more towards the surface to be able to sort of have, you know, those building blocks and that the whatever forces or whatever, you know, events precipitate the formation of life. You know, I wonder. I mean,
we don't really know what really precipitates, you know, life.
Sure.
Right.
Well, they've been doing some experiments and they've been able to sort of reproduce some of those building blocks in a lab. Obviously.
But I mean, for sure, like we know that there's the way that we have developed, but we still have to know if there's other way. I did read a study and we don't need to get detailed because I don't remember everything and don't have it on hand. But there was a scientist who was developing mechanisms for them to be able to run on things other than what we do, meaning that we're starting to delve into fields where we're saying, okay, what else could life be based upon, and what would be the mechanisms that would allow that life to flourish?
Right. Well, and you know, we also have based a lot of our assumptions on, you know, carbon-based life forms, just because that's what we experience mostly here on Earth. But it's possible that life forms elsewhere are, you know, made out of other things. In fact, there's on Earth even there was an arsenic-based life form that was discovered on Earth. So, you know, it's very possible that life could take a very many different forms. And so, you know, you never quite know. If it turns out that life can exist based on things other than carbon, then that opens up the Drake equation to even, you know, more possibilities of life, you know? So it's pretty fascinating to, as we're starting to peer around our own little neighborhood here, to see signs that, you know, life could be potentially, or life supporting environments could be pretty prevalent.
I agree. And just as a little shout out to those who kind of do around the same type of stuff that we do, which is try to give science to everybody and mm-hmm. help anybody understand it. I got a lot of this information in a concise way from the Planetary Society. So if you guys ever want to look at something pretty interesting, they always have pretty good blog topics. That would be a good place to look.
So, yeah, absolutely.
So moving on, going to a little more social here, there was a study that was done, and it was talking about fathers and their involvement with their children and how that affected their work environment, right? And okay. So one of the big things that they found is that by being involved in your family life, you were happier and more satisfied in the workplace, which obviously leads to positive outcomes for the organizations.
Sure.
But the one thing it also found was that those who were more dedicated to their children or more involved in their family life actually showed a decrease in work-related drive going up the food chain kind of thing. You know what I mean?
So they were less likely to advance necessarily.
Well, they defined it as a weakened career identity.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right.
Well, I mean that, you know, speaking as someone who has kids, there's definitely a pull or a tug of war, or a give and take, if you will, when it comes to balancing family and work. And so, I, as you know, went back and got a PhD over the last 6 years after I already had a clinical degree and was running a practice. And there's no question that took away from my involvement in the family, even though right. I still tried to make a very, you know, definite effort to try to spend as much time with the kids and with my wife as possible. There's no way that you can't have some sacrifice, you know? And so now that I'm done with that, all of a sudden I have all this extra time I'm spending with the kids. So,
right,
you know, it's sort of hard to find that balance. I mean, if you want to be able to move up, that means sometimes getting more education. That sometimes means, you know, putting in extra hours at work. And it's a tough balance. I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit of a study that I read recently where the funny thing about it was that the study basically said that over the past sort of, you know, 30, 40 years, that men have generally been less happy, less satisfied than they were in prior years, whereas women's level of satisfaction has increased or improved.
Well, and hold on, just to put something in there real quick. What it also found was that when these males that were heavily involved with their children's lives, although it decreased from their worker identity, when they had managers who understood what they wanted out of life and kind of supported the fact that they were a family man as well as a hard worker, they found that it was actually the opposite, and that those people could develop a very strong work identity and remain a very strong, father. And I think that has loads to what you're saying right now, which is that over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a transition in upper management to away from this quote organizational man, what the perfect person or organizational person, you know, I mean, what you want from an employee, and that has morphed from a hardworking, you know, doesn't interact with his family as much to a full, well-rounded person, which is hopefully where we want to move as a society.
Sure. Well, not only that, but the roles in the household have changed quite a lot in the last 30, 40 years. You know, there was
and
a
by the
time,
way, I do think for the better, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, what I'm getting at is that there's, you know, or what this other study was getting at was that generally women have become more satisfied, whereas men have become less satisfied with their lives. I don't have the study right in front of me, but part of that's because the roles have, you know, there's more demands placed on the men in terms of doing things like housework and chores and, you know, those kinds of things, which for a lot of men, I would imagine, decreases their life satisfaction.
And also,
you know?
Think about freedom for a woman and control for a man, right? Control for most men is something that they like, and taking that away will decrease your satisfaction. And increasing your freedom to make choices, which is something that has happened over the last 100 years for women, will definitely increase your satisfaction, not only in life, but in your workplace.
Sure, and having a more women in the workplace, a lot of them are getting more job satisfaction, so their level of happiness and satisfaction has increased in general terms. Obviously, these are all big generalizations.
We're not going to get into any of those type of issues.
Yeah, but I mean, like my wife, for instance, has a job that she really loves, and she makes a nice living at it, and makes good money, and this is something that she's just, you know. So, you know, she has a nice degree of personal satisfaction out of her work. And then she's also getting more help from me now that I'm not doing the PhD. So, you know, her level of life satisfaction presumably has increased. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Whereas, you know, I am the kind of person that I want to be involved with the family. But I don't like chores like most men don't, or most people don't. But what I'm saying is it's interesting to see that there's been a shift, and basically what it means is that it's evening out a little bit more.
As long as you get the proper allowance for your chores, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, you know, it's like everything else. Certainly there's this really, you know, stereotypical Mad Men era type of a probably inaccurate history of how life was for the average male in the 50s, where you had liquid lunches and you
can't. No, I disagree. From all the stories I hear from the people who lived not in there, but in the 70s and 80s and aerospace and that type of stuff, that is the way that it was. That patriocracy, I guess you could call it, was a reality.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's long gone, at least in my household. You know,
no, I agree,
and you know,
and the liquid lunch was a norm.
What's that?
I said the liquid lunch was a norm even 20 years ago.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, I come home and I have a liquid dinner, but
you're not working, you know, afterwards. There's a difference.
Yeah, but I don't. But I also don't expect, you know, my wife works a full-time job as well, so I don't expect her to make dinner. It's every once in a while, or, you know, maybe once or twice a week she'll have dinner made, and once or twice a week I'll have dinner made. And so we sort of just split those duties. So it's just a more egalitarian life, you know, where we're both as involved as we can with all of those aspects of life. And so I think in general, that means that things have evened out a little bit more when it comes to satisfaction. You know what I'm saying? Instead of having men be much more satisfied with their work lives and things like that, and women less satisfied as it was perhaps, say, 20 or 30 years ago, it's a little more even now.
Right.
But the interesting thing about it was, one last thing I want to say about this was that the the person or the organization or the blog that I read the original like accounting of the story basically framed it that men complain more than women. And I was like, wait, that's not what the study's saying. They got a kick out of saying, well, men complain more. And it was like, well, that's no, the study is saying that men are less satisfied. There's been a change. So they have more complaints. You know what I'm saying? But it's not that men complain more. That's not what the study shows.
Did
So it
that
does show
did that
you
affect
how,
you?
right, it does show you how the information can be spun in such a
Right.
way to be denigrating one way or the other. You know what I mean? So I thought that was kind of an interesting side note when you see how you have to it just show you have to go read the actual study, because I was like, what, men complain more? I'm like, I don't think that's the case, at least in my life. Not that my wife complains a lot, but I try not to complain hardly at all. And then I went and read the study, and it was like, oh no, that's not what they're saying at all. They're
Yeah. No,
saying that
I
men
hate it
are
when it's
not
like
as
that.
satisfied as they used to be, you know.
I hate when it's like that and you can't read the study. It's like you have to buy the study or
Yeah.
something. Like they should just be freely released, but I understand.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, because of my relationship with the university, I have access to all
Yeah.
the journal articles, so I can go read them. But yeah, the paywalls are really frustrating. It's why the proliferation of open source material has really been a nice change, and hopefully that continues.
Something that we've discussed previously, but we've never actually seen success. So recently, JAXA, which is the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, able to use microwaves, and they delivered 1.8 kilowatts of power through the air with, quote, pinpoint accuracy, and it was delivered to a receiver 170 feet away. That's 55 meters away for those who want to be in normal terms. But we were able to deliver power through the air.
Oh, okay.
So this is something that has been discussed for a while. Is this possible? But in order for you to be able to put some type of solar panel array in space and use that energy on Earth, you would need to beam that energy somehow, right? So
Right,
this is a
sure.
conversation and the beginning of the conversation about how it would be possible to put up a solar array. JAXA's actually talked about it for a while, but they want to produce this solar array about in geosynchronous orbit, which would be like 36,000 kilometers or 22,300 miles
Right, right.
from the planet. And they want
Right.
to do it in the next 25 years, 25, 30 years. So th this is that first step, but it's really quite interesting because the ability to move energy between space and the planet without a vehicle would actually be a very good leap in technology.
Oh yeah, it'd be huge. You'd have a lot less loss, I imagine. There's a lot, I mean, I don't know how that all works, but you would imagine there'd be less resistance, right? By using a beam of energy as opposed to, cables or whatever, I would guess. I
Well,
don't know.
it would be awesome to have a cable. A cable would be very efficient. There is
Oh, okay.
loss when you're using this type of stuff. I remember there was a study done in Hawaii, like 5 years ago or something, where they kind of flew a helicopter and beamed, I don't remember if it was microwaves at the time, but some type of energy to a receiving station, and that receiving station was actually quite large. It was almost an entire building. But they're talking about this being actually a very small. They don't describe specifically how large the area is, but they say it's quite small. But the energy that they're sending is actually just enough to run, like a pot of water or like an electric kettle type
Oh,
of thing.
okay. So pretty low.
Right. It's
Yeah.
I mean 1.8 kilowatts of power, so it's not a ton of power, but it is. Enough power to be able to do something useful. And the stuff that we have in space doesn't require as much power as the stuff we use on this planet, because obviously it's hard to take that energy. But still, it's really quite interesting that Jax is doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, this is the next we've got to figure out, better, more efficient ways to harvest the energy of the sun and try to have renewable energy sources and all these things. I mean, it'd be pretty sweet if we could develop some technologies that would be able to take advantage of the sun a little bit more, and that huge energy source that we have that's essentially limitless in our lifetimes, you know. So yeah, this is the kind of thing that hopefully will sort of change the game when it comes to energy resources.
Well, it's limitless in terms of anything we'd be designing for, right?
Right, sure, of course.
I'd like to design this for a 4 billion year lifetime. The sun's gonna die out, we can't do that.
Right. That's what I mean, you know. It's like, but I mean, these are the kinds of things that it's nice that the general public is starting to come around, at least in this country and probably in much of the Western world, to sort of understanding to some degree what lies ahead when it comes
to natural
resources.
It's more than that. Not even the Western world. The young what I see from stuff that I've seen is the young generation in underprivileged countries and the Eastern world and wherever you want to talk about the non-Western world. I think that the young generation is really latching on to the ideas that have been pushed from, you could call it, the Western world of technology and freedom and everything that's coming. And, you know, I really think that generation is going to, you know, we talk about, you know, Africa, right? I mean, Africa is going to be, you know, 2-3 times the size it currently is in the next 40 years. And so it's very important for the children there to understand the uses of technology and how they can impact their country and their locale and their family, even just by using that and teaching those things to others. Because, you know, it's very difficult to get older people to learn technology. It's very easy to get older people to learn technology if their kids are involved with that technology and take the time to teach them. So, you know, you can't change without the children.
I don't know if you, here's the thing. So I don't know if you saw that. This was several years ago. It was a young man who had built his own windmill, like a power. Power for his family, you know, and he just built it himself, you know, as a young kid, basically a teenager, I think. And, you know, was able to generate power that his family could use, you know. So, you know, that's a fairly, that's not exactly high tech. I mean, those are the kinds of devices that have been around since the Middle Ages, you know. But at the same time, it's cool to see that information is being able to be disseminated in such a way that more and more people are sort of having those light bulbs go off, so to speak, that make them think, oh, hey, I can maybe do something here that would benefit my neighborhood or benefit.
And you know, I have the information to do so.
Right, exactly. Now I can figure out how to do it because I have, you know, a way to learn. So yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of things, and not only that, but in terms of just monitoring diseases and healthcare. I mean, being able to have
the microscopes we talked about previously.
Right, exactly. Having more and more people being able to access technology and connect with one another and all these things is I think generally speaking a good thing for the planet and hopefully, you know, makes both feeding those you know, those people that we're expecting to be born in the next, you know, couple decades a little easier and providing health care for everyone and all those things, you know, improve with technology. So, you know, it's kind of neat. I mean, I think part of this has all been, without a doubt, a lot of it's been sort of revolutionized by the advent of the internet, where technology is progressing at such a rapid rate these days, because information just, I mean, here we are, you know, finding out about what Japanese people were doing based on, something that was done, you know, within the last couple months, and all of a sudden, you know, it's being talked about and that information is being disseminated and, you know, it's amazing.
Right. We've talked about DNA methylation and stuff like that in the past for epigenetic changes. So these scientists took ants, carpenter ants from Florida, actually. And so what they did is first they looked at the genes, right? And they didn't find any differences in the genes of the different types of ants that are different sizes. And they were kind of like, well, you know, how are you getting these different ants when it's all the same genetics going into the ants? And then they're giving them worker ants or fighter ants or whatever they are. So what they did is they took Florida carpenter ants and they produced they conducted some epigenetic experiments where they varied the degree of DNA methylation for specific genes. And the specific ones that they control, the gene that they control growth is called EGFR. Doesn't really mean anything to me, but for specifics, that's what they're controlling in the terms of the DNA methylation. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that just by controlling that methylation, they were able to control the large or small size of the carpenter ants. So by modifying the methylation of that specific gene by 20%, led to a 20% change in the size of the ant. And they were able to produce ants that were half the size of normal worker ants to anywhere from twice the size of a normal, very large soldier ant. So it was quite interesting to see how the size of every single part of this ant could be changed by literally just changing the expression of those genes through that DNA methylation change. And if you take this, I know this is only on ants and this is not on humans, but if you take this outside the box and say, well, what can we do? Well, it shows evidence that environmental factors affect your height, your weight, your everything, right? Because that's what's changing the methylation of your DNA at certain mm-hmm. times in your age. And it could also mean that by giving children certain things at a young age, you could create a very tall group of children, right? Possibly. Sure. Yes. Very soon, most likely not, but it's still quite interesting.
Well, I mean, this is just basically harnessing the natural processes that already occur in the body and in the brain.
Right.
EGFR is epidermal growth factor receptor, and it binds like any other.
See, I knew it would mean something to you.
Yeah, it binds like any other receptor to a ligand. So. Some sort of molecule that would bind and then activate downstream messengers within the cell that would cause this DNA methylation to occur. And so it's one of those things that they're basically learning how those how the normal cell signals within the body precipitate changes, right? So mm-hmm. as those receptors are activated, that has changes which are going to increase size or even increase or alter, DNA expression. So, the more we understand, I mean, it's interesting. This brings up an interesting point, which is that we learn a lot about how the human body works by looking at things like ants and fruit flies and of course, even, rats and mice seem pretty obvious, but there's a whole lot of work being done on the Drosophila fruit fly is one of the key ones because there's a lot of techniques available for modifying.
Well, and they have a very short lifespan.
Right, exactly. So you can, but I mean, the point of the matter is that these same basic receptors and the same basic building blocks, many of them are evolutionarily preserved. So, we as humans contain EGFR, right? Epidermal growth factor receptors, right?
Right.
Which are a similar receptor found in an ant, right? So we can, it's a little harder to manipulate humans, right? And give them and try to make these changes. That has a lot of ethical problems, but you can make those changes in an ant or a fruit fly or maybe a mouse or a rat and see how that affects that animal. And then you can sort of extrapolate that information and build upon that information to sort of have, relevance, for humans. So it's pretty fascinating how that type of research works. And it's the kind of thing that brings up a lot of ethical questions over time in terms of how we apply some of this knowledge, but it does,
right. Should we create giants? Should we create will we create cyclopses and then have a war of gods and put them into the underworld?
That sounds like a plan. Why don't we do that? But I mean, part of this is just understanding the downstream, all the downstream molecules are involved, and
it takes time to fully understand that, and we're scratching the surface, scratching.
Yeah, that's what's really crazy about all that stuff is that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
Well, so to talk about that, our next topic is if I were to say hibernation to you, what would you think? You would think cold weather climate. You would think some type of mammal. You would think it has sure. to go to sleep so it, because it doesn't have resources to eat, and it needs to, you know, slow down the energy use through that sure. that time, right?
That or maybe like a snake or something. You know, snakes go into hibernation okay. in the wintertime because they have
but
to.
But a snake isn't a mammal, right?
Right, right, okay. right. That's what I mean. This doesn't always have to be a mammal. It can be a snake, for instance. You know, like rattlesnakes go into hibernation. You know, that kind of thing.
So specifically, I'm talking about mammals. And so they okay. have found in Israel the very first mammal species that they have been able to say actually does hibernate in a constant warm temperature. So actually in Israel's Great Rift Valley, from October to February, they were measuring these bats, and they found that they were able to go into a semi-conscious, breathing once every 15 to 30 minutes with a low energy, and the temperatures in the cave are around 68 degrees. And so previously it was believed that the only mammalian hibernation in Israel were hedgehogs.
Okay.
But, you know, now there's
evidence of right. right. Yeah, I wonder
for a bat.
I wonder if there'd be an advantage for hibernation for humans. I mean, other than things like space travel or whatever, you know, we've talked
well,
about
I mean,
the,
it would be awesome thing. To hibernate like during Chicago winters, but so well, one of their main findings was that hibernating animals don't need to lower their body temperatures in order to lower their energy expenditure. Because these bats exhibited a very dramatic metabolic depression at their warm body temperatures. And these are some of the hottest caves in the Israeli desert. I mean, they're actually quite warm. So they also actually found that this I thought was funny, that the bats flared their nostrils like camels to conserve water. And a month before they started hibernating, they changed their diets from unsaturated to saturated fats by eating only on queen ants with wings to gain a 50% increase in their body mass before they went into this hibernative state. So that's quite interesting. And the most interesting part about it is we didn't think this was possible.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's weird to think of. Well, I guess, you know, we see it. There must be bats around here must hibernate because we only see them certain times of the year. You know, we see. Do you guys have bats in Chicago?
I haven't seen any, but it's.
No, we get bats out here, and you can tell as soon as the mosquito and fly and bug population starts to pick up around here. All of a sudden, you'll see bats out in the twilight hours.
Right, but remember the caves there in the desert where you guys are not warm in the winters, right? They're actually quite cold relatively. These are quite warm caves for that time period. And that's the point here is that they're not going into a cold state and doing it, that it's coming just out of the fact that, you know, there's heat around, there's everything. They're just doing it to conserve that energy intake.
Right. I mean, it's just showing that there's different ways to make it happen, you know? So it's pretty interesting.
That's a good
really
point. There's always a different way to make it happen, right?
Right. Exactly. So, well, cool. Do you want to end it here and
actually,
call it a good episode?
I got one other topic I just want to bring
topic.
Up.
Okay.
So, I actually just was reading this morning and it was a scientific article that the, It's hard to actually say. No, I'm kidding. The main theory was it wasn't a theory. Dogs prefer to poo along a north-south axis generally.
Oh, really?
So what does that mean? So they monitored 70 dogs from 37 different breeds, and they actually, I think it was like 50,000 or 5,580 urinations and 1,893 defecations. And what they found was that generally the reason that the dog kind of does that dance and turns is because they're trying to align with the north-south axis. And what they found is that generally they're trying to align with that as long as the magnetic field at the time is not wavering or moving, meaning if it's a constant magnetic field and there isn't much change going on during the specific time that animal is going to the bathroom, it's going to prefer, whether consciously or unconsciously, to align its body in a north-south way. And if it's a constant magnetic field, they never they never align themselves in east-west direction. If there's a fluctuating magnetic field, it kind of like must be throwing them off somehow, and every once in a while they kind of do orient in east-west direction. But it was actually quite interesting, because why would this dog be doing it? Is it making the dog feel better? Are they actually sensing the magnetic field? We're not sure.
Yeah, that is weird. Why would they?
Yeah. Well, but you always see the dog like kind of do that dance, yeah, right? And they turn. You're like, why does he care what direction he's in? Right.
Yeah, it is weird. My dog, of course, doesn't do any of that. He just drops a poo wherever he wants to.
Well, he doesn't care about that damn magnetic field.
He doesn't. I mean, my dog is not an example of this. Yeah, I've had dogs in the past that do this. But our dog now, I mean, he's dropped a deuce on a chair before.
Wait, but does that mean he's less sensorily perceptive?
Yeah, I think he's kind of dumb, actually. So he's missing some sort of sensory perception.
Well, I'm glad you're nice to all the dogs.
He's a fun dog, but he's clearly doesn't have the same.
Well, I think that's a good way to end it for everybody to digest, is some good poo talk.
Right, exactly. Well, it's good to talk to you again, Blake, and thanks to everyone for listening. And
And if you guys buy anything on Amazon, make sure you go to relativemedianetwork.com, click through our Amazon link, and that gives us a little money based on what you're already going to buy. We would appreciate it, and we love doing this, and we'll see you next week.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you soon, bro.